Hello and welcome back to episode 21 of the Red Sox On Deck podcast, part of the Over the Monster podcast network. I'm your host, Bob Osgood, joined as always by Shelley Verstraete. And Shelley, that Garrett Richards extension that you've been asking for months looks like has a good chance now, huh?
This last Garrett Richards outing was I'm ready to kind of like transition him to the bullpen,
And just a heads up for everyone, Shelley's dogs are a little grumpy today, I think as a result of that start as well, so anything you might hear in the background. But we're very excited to introduce our guests for this week, the director of scouting at the illustrious SoxProspects.com, as well as the co-host of the Sox Prospects podcast. You can find him on Twitter at Ian Kundle. Ian Kundle, thanks so much for joining us today. How's it going?
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I've really enjoyed listening to you guys too, and following the Over the Monster site, obviously. I think it's because I've been on some of the other podcasts, and everyone obviously reads all your stuff all the time, so it's nice to finally get to chat with you guys and gals.
Absolutely, yeah, and what better time to have you on than right after the MLB draft, minor league draft. We did a wrap-up episode 2 weeks ago where we covered the picks 1 through 20, some more in-depth than others, and a lot has happened since that episode. I think we'll kind of jump right into that. Ian's also going to talk a little bit about the depth of the Red Sox system, what's changed this year, a couple of players that all three of us are fans of that are up with the big league squad now. But we're going to get started with Marcelo Meyer. Signed last week for slot value, $6.664 million. I know it was a surprise to us, Ian, going into draft day. Who were you expecting the Red Sox to get at number four? You know, if you had to have made a prediction that morning, and was there even a chance in your mind that Meyer, who was number one on a lot of lists and quite a few mock drafts as well, could end up with the Red Sox?
Yeah, it was an interesting draft day, because I remember I was talking to a few people that day of, and his name was just not someone I was even considering. Just wasn't even in the rearview mirror. There was no thought of him being there, because it was kind of a wide just assumed that he was going to go first overall, and if he didn't, he would go third.
Right.
And then so it kind of was setting up that we had the chaos, situation for the Red Sox would have been if Meyer, Henry Davis and Jack Leiter all went, and then I would have had no idea what they would have done. Maybe they go under slot, and that was kind of what I was expecting to happen, since it seemed pretty like Texas was going to take Leiter at two, and we just assumed Meyer would go one, and then that would push, or excuse me, Meyer or Davis would go one, and then the other one would go three. And then when that didn't happen and Davis went one, it was like, oh, this is interesting. And then the rumor started that Detroit was going to take Jobe, and then it was, oh wait, we actually have to write stuff off about Marcelo Meyer, who's someone we didn't really research or do much work on, because why would we? He was supposed to go first. And so it was interesting that some people at the site, we pre-write the articles about the first round draft pick, and usually when you're in the 20s it's a little more difficult. This year we thought, oh, there's no way they would draft someone that we didn't write up, and of course they did. So it was a very interesting day, and I don't think honestly it couldn't have fallen, as soon as it was clear the Red Sox really wanted Leiter. I think that was pretty widely reported, and as soon as that was off the table, I think that was getting Meyer fall to them was probably the best case scenario, because he's the type of dynamic up the middle player that you don't get. Those guys aren't high school up the middle players with potential, above average to plus hit tool power, and then at least average to better defense. Just that doesn't fall to the 20s or 30s. You don't get guys like him there. So they had a very unique opportunity to pick fourth this year, and they really took advantage of it.
I remember watching the draft, and I honestly never thought that Meyer would fall to number four. Like, he was definitely my first guy on my quote-unquote draft board, but I never thought that he would fall. Do you think that the whole COVID year and just everything that happened after that, do you think that made the draft more unpredictable? than usual, or is it just kind of how it just kind of fell?
I do think it made it more unpredictable. I don't necessarily think it had as much of an impact at the very top with those certain picks. Because I think like someone like Meyer has been scouted for years. You know, he was on the same high school team as Keone Cavico, the Twins' first-round pick 2 years ago. And so scouts have a long track record with him, and the Red Sox especially, because Nick York, the Red Sox first-round pick in 2020, is from the same area as Meyer. So they played against each other in high school. So the Red Sox scout in that area has seen, you know, had a long track record with him, and something they could fall back on when it was clear he was going to, or, you know, when he started to fall. But I think as you move down the draft, it definitely impacted it. You know, you had certain situations like Jordan Lawler going sixth to Arizona as someone who, because of the COVID season, his high school season was done extremely early. And then you compare that with someone like Khalil Watson, whose fit was still playing like right up until the draft. And so you had, you know, scouts were seeing Lawler early, but then getting off him and then getting on Watson, things like that. Or I think the biggest impact you saw was with the more analytically and model driven teams, you know, the teams like the Cleveland, the Dodgers, and then of course the Angels. They just went pitching heavy. And when you think about it, you know, pitching heavy, it's a lot easier to draft pitchers looking at the models and the analytics than it is hitters. And with pitchers, you know, you can get a sample size a lot quicker than you can with the hitting. So in this situation where you might not do as much in-person scouting for some of those teams, or if you did, you know, and you rely heavily on the models, then it's going to be a lot easier to figure it out with the pitchers than the hitters in a season where everything's just kind of messed up.
I got the feeling with the Angels that, you know, there was just somebody who had walked into a room and said, don't draft a hitter until Trout and Ohtani are in the playoffs. And they took it quite literally and drafted 20 pitchers. I mean, I didn't realize until day three what was going on there, but that's just how I pictured it, that they were just sick of, you know, pitching injuries and not having their staff hold up their end of the bargain and wasting Trout's prime away and potentially Ohtani's as well. Because that was crazy once it got to 20.
It almost made me wonder if it was kind of like a meme. Like, they got to 18 and then they were like, let's just do it anyway. Yeah. Like, who cares? But I do think that if you look at the Angels, like, development, they just have not developed pitchers at all. They've just really struggled to do that. And whereas position players, you know, they've had some guys. Obviously, the Trout, Ohtani. Ohtani doesn't really count. But, you know, Brandon Marsh is coming up, and he's obviously looks like a really talented player. Jared Walsh has turned into a good guy. Joe Adele, book's still out on him, but versus on the pitching side, it's just they've really struggled. They've had to spend a ton of money on free agency. And yeah, at some point, I think they just were like, we need to address this deficiency in the system. And between like Reed Detmers last year, who looks really good, and then the guys they got this year, you know, I think that's going a ways towards trying to remedy that and, you know, get that depth back in the low minors. Kind of like what the Red Sox did, you know, last year with some of their trades and just getting as much as trying to gather as much depth as they can on the mound.
Yep. Getting back to Meyer, you know, as number one picks go, you know, he was the number four pick, but number one ranked on so many lists. Maybe not the generational talent on the surface, but he seems to have very few flaws in his game, including, you know, his great drive, makeup, instincts, and you can just, when you watch film on him, just looks so smooth, both at the bat and in the field and with his arm. Anything that concerns you talent-wise that, you know, I'm not saying that would be short of being a superstar, but that could prevent him from even being an everyday player in the major leagues?
I mean, there's always things you can't foresee happen. Like, injuries is the first thing that comes to mind. You know, you can never predict certain things. Like, of course. I think Anderson Espinosa is a good example of that. He's one of the most talented pitchers I've ever seen in person, and he's had 2 Tommy John surgeries since then. And obviously, it's more of a concern with pitchers than hitters. But, you know, there's definitely the injury. You know, fluky injuries happen, but I think just in terms of talent alone, the only thing that is a little bit, you know, a question mark is the reports on whether or not he can stick at shortstop or mixed. Some people are very confident he could. I know, like, we talked to Jim Callis in our podcast, and he said that he was the best defender in the draft, for example, I think at shortstop, or best, like, middle infield defender in the draft. And then, but I know I talked to some scouts who saw him, and they were just a little concerned because he's a big kid. He's like 6'3", 190 already. You know, when you're that big as an 18-year-old, it's a non-zero chance he can end up being like, you know, 6'3", 6'4", 225 at his peak. And if you're that, you know, that big, and he's already kind of like a fringy runner, you know, that might push him off shortstop to third. But even there, it's the type of bat that could profile pretty much anywhere if he reaches his potential. So, yeah, I mean, there's a ton of upside. There's obviously risk because they're always with high school guys, but he seems kind of have he seems to have more of a higher floor than your normal high school draftee.
Sure. Shelley, we had a question from a big fan of the show, Jake Devereaux.
Who is this Jake Devereaux guy? I don't know who he is. but yeah. So Jake really kind of like had a question. So over on your site, SoxProspects.com, which everyone should just go to every single day. There, you know, your current, you know, July version of the rankings have Tristan Casas, Duran, Downs, Jimenez, and Hauk. And for your top five, where do you think Meyer kind of like fits in there? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Actually, I've done more of kind of, I have to work on my rankings. Actually, thank you for reminding me for when we add the draftees in on the next week or two. But I think for me, he's going to be in the top three. And if I had to guess, my number one prospect is going to be him or Casas for next month. And I think the big thing for me is just his, if he can stick at shortstop, which, as I said, it's kind of like mixed reports, but it seems more people think he can than don't. Then if he's a shortstop with a potential, you know, above average to plus hit and above average to plus power, that's just a remarkably valuable player. And I love Tristan Casas. I mean, we've been on him since he was drafted and been probably we've been extremely high on him since then and had him, you know, number one for a while. But he's a first baseman at the end of the day. You know, a shortstop is going to be more valuable than the first baseman, even if the shortstop's hitting ability is not as good as the first baseman's because of the defensive value that Meyer could add there. And so I think he's going to be first or second, and it's just going to depend on kind of as I dig into it, talk to some scouts, and then probably err on the conservative side and put him second, honestly, but he could be first. It's going to be, though, in that top three for sure.
Yeah, and do you have any feel as to where he might start the year yet, in terms of, you know, Salem or in Florida?
I think he's in Fort Myers right now, I'm pretty sure, and I think he'll get into some games in the FCL in the next, you know, couple of weeks, and then I would expect, you know, depending on how he does, how he looks, just getting up to speed game wise since his high school season's been over for a while, I would assume the Red Sox would like to get him into some games at Salem, like they like to do at the end of the season, kind of promote guys to give them a taste of what they're going to expect for the next season. So I think that is most likely the plan based on kind of the past track record of what the Red Sox have done with their high draftees.
Yep, that all makes sense. All right, thanks for all of that. Moving on to round two, Judd Fabian out of Florida. You know, it seemed in the second round, in the same way as the first, that we kind of had a gift, you know, fall in our laps there at the 40th pick. But as the past week has unfolded, there's some rumors, and I know Peter Gammons reported recently that he wasn't going to sign unless he got to a 3 million number, which sounded like, you know, perhaps some teams behind the Red Sox at 40 had promised him, and that was an expectation. So the slot for that 40th pick is about $1.86 million. Do you think the Red Sox have a way to get close to that $3 million number, you know, even if they didn't sign some other draftees in the process?
The $3 million number is going to be really hard to get to, and it's because of the way the draft structure or the draft slotting system works. The Red Sox currently have 3.1 million about left in their bonus pool, and that's assuming they're going to spend to the full 5% overage, which they will. They've done that pretty much every year. And except with the way it works, you can't just allot 3 million to him and sign the other guy and just, you know, not sign the other guys. In order to get that full 3.1 million, they have to sign fifth round pick Nathan Hickey also, and he's someone who also reportedly wants overslot, which is something we've heard and a few other people have. And if he gets over slot, that's going to eat into that bonus pool to the point where even if Hickey signs for slot, the most they could get to is about 3.6 million, 3.7 million, or sorry, 2.6 million, 2.7 million, excuse me. And that's assuming Hickey's going to sign for slot, which all indications are he isn't. Right. And so it just makes it that the most they can probably get to, if let's say Hickey gets 725, which I don't think is likely. I think it's going to be closer to a million. If he's even at 700K, the most they can still get to is like 2.4, 2.5. So it's just going to be, they can't get close to the 3 million number realistically, unless Hickey signs for 100K, which I just don't see any reason why that would happen. You know, if he's going to take 100K, especially since he's only a sophomore, he might as well just go back to school. So the odds of them getting the 3 million are not close. And I think it's just kind of going to be, you know, this is the most we can offer based on what it is, take it or leave it. And if, as of right now, it seems like his side is saying he's going to leave it, but at the end, it could all be negotiations. You know, it's these things happen. Usually they're not very public. But like behind the scenes, this stuff has been going on for a while. And, you know, I think we'll just know, we'll find out Sunday for sure. But as of now, as you said, it does not look good.
Yeah. So do you think that they would kind of like focus on Fabian versus the, you know, the catcher also from Florida? Or do you think that they'll just, you know, give Hickey the money and then just kind of like just take that second round pick and get it like next year? Like, do you think that's where they're kind of focusing?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because if they don't sign Hickey, they lose about 400K plus the 405% thing. So they basically lose like 500K from their slot. So they could sign Fabian for about 2.6 million, but they wouldn't get a fifth round pick back next year. So the calculus is, you know, and that's assuming he would take 2.6, which we don't know. But if the calculus is that, or you can sign Hickey, sign, you know, someone like Nico Cavadas in the 11th round, and then also have the 41st pick next year because they would get a compensation pick for not signing Fabian, because the top three rounds you get one versus obviously in the fifth round you wouldn't. I'm not sure, you know, which you would prefer, and I think you can make a strong case that it would be better to have the compensation pick in Hickey along with maybe one or two wild cards after the 10th round than just Fabian, and if you can get, you know, Cavadas and other guys for slot.
With the you know, the first round being on its own day, do you think that the Red Sox probably should have had a better feel going into day two, you know, having the whole night and the, I guess, going into Monday morning to kind of reset their board, look at, it's really just a handful of players that they would have had with their pick early in the second round, you know, to better understand how much it was going to take to sign Meyer and what Fabian was looking for. Would you say that's something they should have had a better feel for, or do you think the picks after the second round dictated what ended up happening with Fabian?
I think that in this situation, you know, agents are going to throw out big numbers. They're going to try to get their player the best possible deal. And I think like someone like Jay Groom is an example, where Jay Groom supposedly had a offer, I think it was over $4 million, from the Padres in the 20s in the draft where the Red Sox took him 12th. And he ended up signing for $3.6 million, which was, I think, right around slot. And, you know, just because someone has an offer doesn't mean that you have to give them that amount of money. And if they thought Fabian was the best player on his board, they could have known his number and said, that's fine, we're still going to take you anyway. And, you know, you can sign for the amount we want, or you can go back to school. And, you know, right now we don't know. That still could happen for all we know. You know, he might eventually settle and they find middle ground and he signs for 2.2, 2.3, 2.4. So I think that they did do that, and they just decided that the talent was worth, you know, taking there. And if they can come to an agreement, great. And if not, we'll fall back on a pick next year and draft where, you know, our bonus pool won't be as high. So it'll be nice having an additional $1.82 million to tack onto it. Because with the way the Red Sox are going, you know, they're probably going to be picking at the end of the first round and some, you know, in the 20 to 30 range, where you're not getting close to as much as you had this year when you were picking fourth. So it's, you know, it'd be a nice little bonus to have to their pool next year.
Yeah, and it's kind of hard to look at that in the long run, but you get the exact same pick back, like you said, and maybe in their head they were saying, we're offering this guy, we can offer him up to 33% pretty much over the slot. So you can see from their aspect, and sometimes it's hard in the moment to say, well, you know, well, we don't want the pick next year, we want the player that's right in front of us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if they're picking close to 25 to 30 next year and then have another one shortly after that, you know, a year from now, you'll be happy with that. So,
well, exactly, and that gives you a lot more flexibility, because I think, you know, they are really lucky this year with how bad they were last year that they got the fourth pick. That slot is $6.6 million, whereas you look at, you know, last year in their draft, granted they only had four picks, but that their first round pick alone was worth more than all four of their pick slots for last year. And like, you go to 2019 where they picked, they didn't have a first round pick again, but again, like, their first round pick was $6.6 million this year. In 2019, their entire bonus pool was $5 million, basically. Like, when you're picking at the end of the first round, you just don't have the same opportunities. And if you're adding another, you know, $1.82 million to that money, that makes a big difference in what you can do for the entire draft. Whereas this year, you know, they clearly liked Fabian. They took him there, but they had a number in mind. And yeah, and if they can't come to an agreement, you know, you have that security blanket of having the pick next year.
Some of the remaining unsigned players, and you've talked about it a little bit, Nathan Hickey in the 5th, Nico Cavadas in the 11th, Peyton Green in the 15th, Josh Hood in the 20th. Those are just four kind of most notable names, among a couple others that come to mind. It sounds to me, trying to read between the lines there, that Fabian plus Hickey plus Cavadas would be difficult. And I know that Peyton Green seemed more likely to go back to school. So are you able to kind of give just a feel for, you know, percentage type of chance that you think some of those later, you know, Shelley's going to ask about Cavadas in a second, mm-hmm. And go a little bit more in depth, but just a feel for who you think is a possibility and who's a definite no?
Well, I think Peyton Green's a definite no. I don't see any chance he signs. His number was over $1 million, and he, you know, was someone the Red Sox considered in the second round. And if the draft had fallen differently, I think there was a chance they would have taken him there. Sure. So that's not going to happen in the 15th round. You know, he's someone you circle. The reason you draft him is you build a relationship with the kid, and then you circle back in 3 years and we'll see what happens. Josh Hood, similarly, there's been nothing that has linked them to him signing. And he's just a unique case because he didn't play at all this year. The Ivy League didn't have a spring season because of COVID. So he hasn't really been scouted since 2019. And when he did, you know, that was what, an 8-game season or something.
Right.
So he has leverage. He's transferring to NC State to be their starting shortstop for next season, which ironically is where Peyton Green's going also. So Hood seems kind of unlikely just because we haven't heard anything, but I guess I wouldn't rule it out. If I had to guess, I would say that Hickey is going to sign, Cavadas is going to sign. And I think Luis Guerrero, the 17th round pick, has a chance to sign also, but I think Green and Hood are definite no's, and Fabian is trending down.
Yeah, when it comes to Cavadas, like, this is a guy that, just as I was watching, like, the draft go on for, like, you know, about 3 days, him falling to the 11th round, I was just like, I fell in love with the kid. Right?
I mean, he hit some bombs, so it's a lot of fun to watch.
Exactly. Did he fall this far just because he's already a first base DH type of guy? Like, why is this type of hitter, why did he fall so far?
I think it's a combination of a few things. I think the first one is just the profile is tough. You know, coming out of the draft, teams want up the middle guys. They want guys who have good defensive profiles to fall back on. And he's just your prototypical old school masher type. You know, he's a 20 runner. He's probably, you know, a below average defender, and he's most likely a DH. And so that's just, in this day and age, teams just don't value that as much as they used to. And I think that pushed him down. I think his age and the fact that he is, you know, on the older side, I think he's 22, 23, pushed him down a little bit. And then I think it's also that, you know, there's just so much pressure on his bat, and he's got raw power, but the hit tool, maybe it's a 45, maybe it's a 50, maybe it's a 40. You know, if you're talking about a guy who's like a 45 hit tool, 70 raw power guy, that's in this day and age, that's just a tough fit. So I think just the combination of all those factors pushed him down. And it could have also been, honestly, his contract demands. You know, we don't know what his signing bonus, what he was asking for. But as a college junior, he didn't have a lot of leverage. And maybe he told teams, you know, I want this much or I'm not signing. And you can push yourself down, as we saw with several other guys. It's usually high school guys who do it. But there are also situations where college guys push themselves down because of their bonus demands. So I think just a combination of all those factors caused him to be there in the 11th. But, you know, the Red Sox obviously seemed very happy because they popped him with their 11th round pick, which is usually where you take, you know, that priority guy that fell that you were interested in. And someone, you know, in the past drafts, for the most part, save for Sebastian Keane, I think 2 years ago, they've signed their 11th round pick. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with him in the coming days.
Yeah, I know. In my head, I'm thinking there's going to be 15 more DH spots pretty soon. So the first base DH type will have, you know, 60 spots instead of 45 right now.
It's a good point because, you know, teams, when you look at the National League teams right now, they're just not enough good hitters. You know, even some of the starting guys aren't good. And now they're going to be having to fill a DH most likely when the new CBA comes in. So it definitely could, increase the value of someone like him. But at the same time, like, the Red Sox have a plethora of these, first base DH types in their farm system. And I think, like, a good example as we're approaching the trade deadline, guys like Pedro Castellanos, Devlin Granberg, Tyreek Reed are all guys, they might not be have as much upside offensively as someone like Fabian, but they're all guys who are probably not going to be added to the 40-man roster and are bat first, first base DH types, and that type of profile just doesn't have as much value in the game as it used to.
I'm still holding out hope for Joe Davis.
Big Joe. one of my favorite guys to watch. His season in Lowell, was it 2 years ago in 2019, was one of the most remarkable things and most fun things. He ran through a stretch. I think it was, in the playoffs, he had like three straight walk-offs or something. But yeah, he's another example of like that college masher type, and kind of get up to the high minors and see what you can do.
Before his promotion, he was something like more than one RBI a game when I was looking at his stats on the promotion.
That position is somewhere that they've done a really good job of finding value late. Like Joe Davis, as you said, was a senior sign. Tyreek Reed was a minor league rule five pick. Devlin Granberg was another senior sign. Like, those are all guys that have put up really strong seasons and just as the masher types. And I think Davis actually homered. He was first high A home run today, so... Wow. That was a fun one. So good timing with the Joe Davis or Big Joe reference. And also my favorite part of it is him and Steven Scott, who is another 2019 draftee, unbeknownst to me, apparently had a nickname. They were the Meatball Bros. And for some reason, I just thoroughly enjoyed that when I saw that on social media. They were tweeting about it. So it raised Davis and Scott's stock even more in my book. And I was probably already one of the highest people around on them.
Yeah, Keaton and I had Kevin DiDomenico, the announcer down at Salem, on about a month ago, and he was talking about Joe Davis fixing up cars, and that was one of the least surprising things to me. So Meatball Bros seems like a fitting nickname for him.
Exactly.
All right, so we're going to move on. Just two quick news and notes before we get into the Sox system a little bit. Chris Sale heading to Worcester after two Portland outings. He was up to 3 2/3 innings. 9 strikeouts in his last outing. I think he gave up a couple runs total over his two outings in Portland. So sounds like there's going to be two more. I was hoping that there would just be one more. Shelley, whose spot do you see him taking in 2 weeks? Garrett Richards.
Exactly. Yeah, especially after this last outing from Richards. Yeah, I think it's going to be Richards. I still have my... hesitance about whether Houck is actually a starter. I'm still a little bit hesitant about that, but I just really just... Richards just needs to go to the bullpen.
Yeah, and with the trade deadline coming up and seeing some of the names beyond the luxury tax, which is about $750,000 or something like that, I think that the Red Sox are under that. I wondered, if Richards had a good start. He was throwing 98 at the beginning of the outing today. I wondered if he had a good start, if they could maybe free up a little bit of money and move him to the NL to make a trade for a different position of need. But it just didn't look good today. Ian, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I still wouldn't rule out something like that. You can always, if they're willing to give up a good enough prospect, they could dump his contract.
Sure.
At the end of the day. So, I think that when Sale is ready, I actually think he probably takes Tanner Houck's spot and pushes Houck back into the bullpen where I think he could be, he'd be more effective this season. But I think that Richards, if they do go down to the five man, then yeah, you're looking at Richards or Martin Perez, and probably Richards, because I just don't see Perez's stuff really doing anything in the bullpen. Whereas maybe you can catch lightning in a bottle with Richards. And as we saw, last year with San Diego down the stretch, I think he was decent in the bullpen role.
Yep. Connor Siebold's rehab been a little bit shaky. I know that he moved up to Worcester in his last start, giving up 6 runs. 3 of those were earned, and 3 1/3. There was some shaky defense behind him, but he walked 4 in that game and only struck out 1. Either of you have kind of any expectations for him? If he gets to the point where he's throwing the ball well, could he potentially be a September call-up? I know they only have a couple of extra spots, but that might be something to see, if they have anything to play with. I'll start with you, Ian. Do you think that he might have any kind of role this year, or is it more just a depth rotation piece and reevaluate the rotation going into next year?
I think he actually could. If you look at their current, the Worcester roster right now, he's the only pitcher they have on the roster who's not on a rehab assignment who's currently on the 40-man roster. So if they need to delve into the minors again and don't want to make a roster move, then Siebold is definitely someone I think we could see making his debut. A lot of it's going to depend on how he throws. Obviously, his first two starts in the Florida Complex League, he looked good from what I've been told. You know, his stuff was good. And, you know, that first Worcester start, I'm just not that concerned. You know, he's coming off of three months off with an arm injury, and it was his first time back pitching in AAA, which is obviously a very big leap up from the FCL hitters he was facing, where I think he struck out like 7 and 6 guys in his first two starts, something along those lines. So, I'm not too worried about him, and I think that as long as he's healthy, that I think there's definitely a chance that he could be up at some point this year.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with Ian there. It's basically more of like a wait and see, especially with the trade deadline, you know, coming to an end at the end of this week. We don't know what the Red Sox can do, but yeah, I think that we could possibly see Siebold towards the end of the year.
All right, moving on to a couple of, you know, former prospects. I guess Duran still has prospect eligibility. We're going to ask about him as well as Garrett Whitlock. And, you know, Whitlock's under 50 innings, even if he's past the amount of service time on the roster. I'm going to bring him up one more time on this show, just because I know that all three of us are fans of both of these players. Starting with Duran, Shelley, kind of what are your thoughts been on his debut so far? Do you think he's up for good? Anything that you've seen at the big league level that has concerned you or been any different than kind of what you saw in the minors?
I really liked what the Red Sox have done so far. Like, they have really really platooned him. Like, he's not really hitting against lefties, but what he is in the lineup, usually against righties, he's hitting second. Do you think that is a thing, Ian? Do you think this is a thing going forward that we need to, like, watch for the entire year? Or is this just them trying to figure out where Duran kind of, you know, fits in with this major league team?
I think that long term, he could be someone who ends up hitting in the two hole. I think though that with what was going on with the lineup, the Red Sox clearly wanted to shake things up. The offense had kind of stagnated before his call up. Guys like Alex Verdugo, JD Martinez, even were kind of scuffling a little bit. And I think that just in order to get that lefty righty balance that Alex Cora likes to have, if you're having Kike Hernandez in the leadoff spot, you want to have a lefty in the two spot, and he's kind of the clear option there. If you're pushing Verdugo down to sixth. So I think that was kind of the reasoning for him jumping in the two hole. But I know tonight, like, he's hitting ninth against the lefty, and even though he had no, you know, noticeable splits against lefties this year in the minors, I do like the way they're kind of limiting his exposure, because the one concern I had coming out, other than the defense, but offensively, my big concern was the swing and miss in his game. With his change swing, he's definitely added more strikeouts, and just his contact, his ability has kind of decreased a little bit, because when you're trying to hit, you know, for power, that's going to happen. And my concern was, how was it going to be exploited by major league pitchers who have much better command than he was seeing in the minors? And the answer is, you know, his swinging strike rate is among the highest on the teams. As you said, the strikeouts have been really high. And if you look even at, like, the pitches he's getting, his sweet spot is kind of middle in and down, and he's just not getting any of those pitches. And I think that it's going to be on him to make adjustments, and that's something that he's shown at every level, the ability to make adjustments. But I do think the growing pains that we're kind of seeing are expected. But if he can get back and, you know, kind of show the dynamic player that he is with his speed, he adds a different element to the lineup that is really nice at the top of the order.
Yeah, that speed has been evident right away. You know, there's a couple plays. There was the ground ball to second the other night where he ended up getting to second base on a ball that barely got out of the infield. I don't know whether he was pinch running late in the game, but just balls in the gaps. He's going to score from first. His arm in center field fits in with all the other arms they have in center field, the way that those, you know, the number of assists that Verdugo and Renfro and Kike have had out there. I mean, Duran fits right in with a couple of the throws that he's made. Haven't gotten to see as much, you know, the jumps that he's getting on balls, but you can tell that he has a good eye at the plate. He's definitely, you know, the swing and miss is there, but there are things that I just want to see him stay up at least for as long as they can. And I guess we're a month away from rosters expanding anyways, but I think that there are a lot of places that he can contribute, especially, as you said, if they pick their spots. He doesn't need to be hitting second every night. If they get him down the bottom of the order, get some confidence back, especially as they face a ton of lefties this week. I think there's other places that he can contribute, even if he is hitting under 200. So,
well, that's the thing, is I think that the importance of this, having a, even as a pinch runner down the stretch, could be vital. You know, we've seen in the past Red Sox playoff runs and in September, the importance of having someone who can run and be that pinch runner. Yep. And even we've seen, saw it this year in that game against the Yankees when he came in and scored from second on that little like line drive single to left field, that I don't think there's any other player on the team who would have scored on that, because he's by far right. The fastest guy. So except for Rafael Devers, who somehow is putting up like elite sprint speeds all of a sudden, which is great. But
I saw that and found it hard to believe that he's on Durant's level. But
I think that he's probably up for good. And whether it be, you know, as the everyday center fielder, or even a bit more kind of like a bit role where he's a, you know, a late inning pinch runner type, he's going to add value to the Red Sox this year. And then going forward, we'll kind of see what happens.
Yeah. So with Garrett Whitlock, you know, like I said, not technically a prospect anymore, still under 50 innings. So I'm going to consider him a prospect in my mind. We've talked about him a lot. To me, it seems like the roles are pretty clear for 2021, especially with Chris Sale coming back and Hauk and the names that we've talked about in the rotation and coming off of Tommy John. I would think he's probably pretty set. But looking ahead to 2022, I would love to see him move into the rotation now that he has three above average pitches, the way that the slider and the change, and they're all moving different directions, and his fastball, which I feel like your scouting report and others had in the mid-90s and is closer to the high 90s, at least as the season has gone on. Movement, separation, velocity. I mean, he checks all the boxes for me. Do you think the organization sees it that way, or might they not want to mess with his role since he's been successful there so far?
I don't think they'll mess with it for this year. I think that for the rest of the season, he's going to stick in the bullpen, both to manage his innings, but also just he's such an important piece back there. You know, you can make the case that after Matt Barnes, he's the most important member of the bullpen. I know Ottavino is vital too, but Whitlock's been better than Ottavino this year. And I think that his ability to pitch multiple innings, you know, they can bring him in any situation, whether it be a close game in the fourth or, you know, give you bridge to the sixth and the seventh inning, is important. And that, you know, that's what he's going to be for this year. But I think for next year, it definitely they will try him out in the rotation. I don't know if he'll, you know, stick there, because that's obviously a big change. But he has all the things you look for in a starting pitching prospect. You know, he's got the big frame, you know, 6'5", 200 pounds or so. He's got three pitches, as Bob said, that above average at least. And I mean, I know scouts who have gone 60s on all of them. And, you know, you're talking about 360 pitches, good size, elite extension, good command. Like, if he was a starting pitcher, if he was, you know, a starting pitching prospect, I mean, when he graduated, he was our top pitching prospect in the system. And I think that for next year, it makes sense to give him a run out in the rotation and see what happens, because, you know, at the end of the day, a starting pitcher is going to be more valuable than even a late inning guy. So, yeah, you definitely are going to, I think they try him there next year.
Yeah, a definite shout out to the Sox prospect site that had him early on, as high as I was seeing him on any prospect list. So you guys were on that early for sure.
Yeah, that was it was, you know, that sometimes it's helpful to when you're talking to people. And he was one that as soon as spring training started and he was throwing, and it was the reports I were getting were just like irresponsible. And it's like, this is a guy, because when they acquired him, he was rule five. He was throwing like, the reports were he's throwing like 90 to 95, you know, which is fine. Interesting guy, but 90 to 95 with an above average slider and a below average changeup. And then he shows up at spring training and he's 94 to 98 with a plus changeup and an above average slider. And it's like, oh, okay, this is a completely different pitcher. Like, yeah. And I think that shows that you don't know what's going to happen after Tommy John surgery. You know, it can go both ways. Some guys, they're going to get better. Some guys are never going to come back the same. And he's just he falls in the bucket of one of the guys who he came back from Tommy John even better than he was before.
Yeah. Shelly, did you want to take the, you know, Cassius Downs, any input on your end or questions for Ian there?
Yeah. I will have to say that Garrett Whitlock has been just like one of like the players that have just been like so much fun to watch, because I didn't really know what to expect, but he just totally blew everything out of the water. But when it comes to casts and downs, I absolutely love Tristan Casas. Like, I like adore the dude. But when he was promoted to Double A, like, his power kind of like dropped off a bit, but then he was also dealing with like some of the Olympic trials and stuff like that. But then also when it comes to Jeter Downs, his strikeout rate is a little, I'll say a little bit alarming, but kind of alarming. His strikeout stuff, like, it's just kind of like gone off the rails. What are your thoughts about casts and downs? Like, have you kind of like rethought maybe what you thought about them, like, going forward? Or is this just kind of maybe just, you know, a COVID 2021 type of thing?
I think it's I haven't really changed what I've thought of Casas. He was my number one prospect coming into the year, and nothing's really changed with that. And if he's not there anymore, it's because they drafted, obviously, with, as we talked about earlier, Meyer could take that, but we'll still see. But I think, you know, Casas is just kind of how his development goes. You know, he's not a guy who's going to sell out to hit home runs. And I think that's something that you got to consider, is a lot of guys will get to Double A, then they'll think, oh, I have to, you know, I'm a first baseman, I'm a slugger, I have to hit, you know, got to hit for power. And that's just not how he's built. You know, he's a hitter. His goal is he wants to get on base, and whether that be by walking, by just getting a single, or by hitting for power, you know, he'll get on base however he can. And I think that's kind of what's happened this year. You know, he's hitting .271, strikeout rate's around 20%, which is great. Walk rate is over 11%, which is excellent. You know, he's still hitting the ball really well, and I've seen him, and I just think the power is something that's just going to come as he matures. You know, you got to remember, he's still only 21 years old. He's on the young side for Double A. He's facing advanced pitching for the first time, having basically skipped Salem entirely. And his seasons were kind of weird, as you said, because of the having to go to going to the Olympics. So I think that long term it'll be fine. It's just kind of, you know, a blip and just a weird situation where he's not hitting for power. Because if you watch his BP, it's still there, and it'll come in game eventually. With regards to downs, I definitely, you know, it's not, the season has not gone how you would have hoped. His strikeout rate, as you alluded to, has been really bad. He's had, you know, one good month back in June. He was good, but his May and his July has been really bad. And in, you know, his strikeout rate is up to 30% in July, 4% walk rate. And I think that with him, that you have to remember that this was an ultra aggressive assignment. You know, he's 23 years old, but he had twelve games in Double A in 2019. And then they just put him in AAA to start the year. So he basically skipped AA entirely. You know, if they started him in AA, it would have been, no one would have batted an eye. And instead, he got the aggressive assignment to Worcester as, you know, a 22, 23-year-old. I think he just turned 23. He actually did just turn 23 yesterday. As a 22-year-old, and he's facing guys, you know, I've seen Worcester a handful of times this year, and I remember going to one game when they were playing the Mets affiliate, and he saw five straight ex-Major League pitchers. It was like Jordan Yamamoto, Jerry Blevins, who are the other ones? There are a couple other ones, but, you know, he's facing pretty advanced arms for someone who barely played in Double A and wasn't known as, you know, the most refined approach person. So I think it's just kind of growing pains, and that long term, I still think he'll be fine. But yeah, as you said, this year has been a little bit of a disappointment.
Looking at Gilberto Jimenez a little bit, I know you have him as of right now at number four. The thing that we've mentioned a couple of times is are the splits between when he's hitting left-handed and hitting right-handed. And from the left side this year, he's hitting .322 on base 37% of the time. And against lefties, when he's hitting right-handed, he has an OBP of only .157. Now, granted, that's 51 plate appearances compared to 220 from the other side. So it's a smaller sample, but we're also starting to get into the second half of the year, and he doesn't have a single walk from the right side, and he's striking out 37% of the time. Have you, and that kind of goes against what I had heard about his swings, you know, that his right-handed swing was a little bit more advanced than from the left side. So this seems kind of counter to that, and have you heard anything just about how he's looked on each side and whether they're, you know, the scouts are kind of reconsidering what his better side might be from hitting from.
Well, I think he's a hard one to evaluate because in the sense that there's very few players who have completely different swings and approaches from each side of the plate, but he falls in that bucket. From the left side, he's a pure, you know, slap and go, just put the ball in play and run guy. And from the right side, he takes a more, you know, a bigger hack. He's got a leg kick. He's trying to actually drive the ball. And I think that it can, you can kind of get caught in between two minds. And I do, I haven't seen him this year, but I've talked to some scouts who have, and I think that's kind of just what he's getting caught in between, that he's not facing a lot of left-handed hitters or left-handed pitchers, excuse me. And when he is, you know, you can kind of get caught between two minds of, this is the swing, you know, that I want to do, but at the same time, I'm having success doing the other one. And so I think that long-term, it's definitely something that bears watching, because I'm not going to, you know, write off his right-handed swing after 50 games, because I've seen it be really good. You know, even last year in fall instructs, scouts came back and said, you know, the right-handed swing was much better than the left-handed swing long-term. But sure. Yeah, it's definitely something worth monitoring, and we'll kind of see as the sample grows larger what happens there. But I just think that for him to be the player he has the potential to be, he needs that right-handed swing to come along, because the left-hand swing works in the low minors. But as you get more advanced, that slap and go, you know, kind of just put the ball in play and run approach is not going to fly as much. And that's kind of the long-term concern I have with him, is how sustainable his hitting ability would be if all he's doing is just kind of slapping the ball for singles.
Looking at a couple of other prospects who started early in the season at the lower levels. One has been promoted, and that's Brian Bayo. Another guy is Nick York. I feel like Bayo has been maybe the biggest riser, maybe not in your eyes, but has jumped on everyone's radar, you know, that may not have been prior to the season. I mean, he was in the Futures game, and I don't think that we saw that coming in the prior to the season, although he and Aldo Ramirez, and we talked about both of them, had a couple of debates on the show. Aldo, more my guy, and I'm hoping that he gets healthy soon. But with Bayo, were these advances that he's made surprising to you, or did you always kind of see that potential for him?
I think that he's been a fun one, and I've actually had the chance to see him this year. So in addition, obviously, as you said, he's been in the Futures game, and he's been someone who kind of, his stock has just constantly been on the rise. And I know coming out of Instructs last year, we were told that he had the best raw stuff of any pitcher there. His velocity had ticked up again. His secondary stuff had improved. And, you know, he was looking potentially now as like a guy who's throwing in the mid-90s. With, you know, a plus secondary pitch, another average one. And then he came out this year, and he's now sitting, I mean, I saw him, you know, he'll sit 96, 98 with a plus changeup and above average slider now. And I think it was one of those things that he's been on the upward trajectory, and then this year was finally the breakout. And, you know, the stuff is excellent. He has that super athletic build. He's got a strong arm, super quick arm. And I think the thing with him is just going to be, now he's got to refine and become more of a pitcher. You know, he can throw really hard, and he'll flash three plus pitches, but he's got to work on those little things, the consistency with his delivery, consistency with his release point. His arm is so quick that it'll get way out in front of his delivery often. He really struggles to command his fastball to the gloves or to the arm side. It's another thing. And then, you know, consistency with his breaking balls, as you saw in the Futures game, if you watched it, you know, he was spiking his slider into the dirt. And when I've seen him, he's had a lot of trouble landing it for strikes. And so that, it's just, you know, it's just going to be consistency and command with him. But on raw stuff alone, he's among, you know, probably the most talented pitcher in the system. It's just refining those aspects of his game will be key to reaching a ceiling.
Yeah. Bayo has really been really excited. Like I always try to like look at the box scores and try to get some video when he's pitching. But there's two other pitchers that I really, really kind of like, I would love to hear your thoughts. Chris Murphy, who has been, I have been, you know, kind of just a fan of his since he was drafted. Basically because when, you know, he's in college, he, you know, was really struggling with the walks. And then when he came, after he was drafted, like the walks kind of like decreased, but he's kind of gone back a little bit more to the walks, but he's looked pretty good. But then also Groom, who, you know, needs to be added to the 40 man this year. I didn't know where he kind of fell in prior to this year, but he has looked really good, like with his last 4, 5, 6 starts. What are your thoughts about Groom and Murphy?
Yeah, you're right. They're two of the guys who have definitely had impressive seasons. I mean, I think starting with Murphy, as you said, it's going to come down to the command and the control with him. His stuff has improved. He's now up to 99. He's sitting, you know, mid 90s. He's got, you know, his secondaries aren't great. It's mostly probably closer to average-ish secondaries than true plus. I think his best secondary to me is this changeup, but it's still more of like an average-ish pitch. But it's just going to come down, as you said, you know, the walks. He's walking just too many guys for my liking. And when your command is off, he's given up 16 home runs and 13 starts this year. And that's, you know, when you're putting guys on base and then giving up home runs, that's a bad, you know, bad recipe when you get up into the high minors. So those are the areas of his game he's going to have to improve on. But he can miss bats. And I think at worst case, you're looking at someone who could be a middle reliever, because the scouts I talked to are pretty split. You know, there's definitely a lot of reliever buzz with him because of the command and then the lack of like a true plus secondary pitch. And then with Groom, as you said, yeah, he's in the best stretch of his career. He's obviously, you know, he's been out for a few weeks as he had the birth of his first child recently. But with him, it's health is what I want to see. You know, I the results are great, obviously, but he just needs to stay healthy. His career high in innings coming into the year, I think, was around like 50. And he's just, you know, he's never made it through a full season. And if he can do that, I think that's the most important part of his development. Because on the field, his stuff has been a little inconsistent. His velocity has been mostly in the low 90s, which is down a little bit than what he used to be. His secondary pitches, though, he's thrown his changeup and his slider a lot more than he used to, which is a very positive part of his development because he's still got that big overhand curveball. And so, you know, I don't know if the ceiling is as high as we thought it once was, but you're looking at a guy, you know, four-pitch guy, with an above average, at least one plus secondary pitch, that's someone you could see in the back end of a rotation, but it's just going to be about staying healthy for him long term.
You know, a pitcher that is at double A, and I'm going to focus on a couple other pitchers here. We'll keep the theme the same. Josh Winkowski, who came over in the Benintendi trade, and he seems to have risen in your prospect rankings at the site as much as anybody. He's up in your top 15 prior to the most recent draft. His strikeout numbers aren't that high. He has 57 strikeouts in 69 innings, but in the couple starts I've seen with him, he really seemed to keep the ball down, had multiple, you know, breaking ball off-speed pitches that were down in the zone. It seemed like his location was good. What has been, you know, the biggest catalyst for Winkowski to move up in your rankings since the beginning of the season?
I think it's just that it's hard when guys get acquired via trade where to rank them, because especially coming after last season, because guys like Winkowski, there was nothing on them from last season. So, you know, if I'm getting reports from 2019, as we saw Garrett Whitlock, I think is the best example of this, things can really change. And so with Winkowski, when the Red Sox acquired him, we didn't really have a good feel for where to rank him. And now I think it was more of just like correcting. Getting him up in the top 20, because I think he's a definite major leaguer. You know, I'm not sold it's as a starter. I think it might be as a bulk reliever, and I think he could be very effective in that role. And I think the reasoning behind that is he's just an interesting pitcher. His fastball is, you know, low 90s, 92, 94. He can get up to 94, 96, you know, in short bursts, but he doesn't really hold his velo over games. But as you said, he's someone who really likes to pitch down in the zone, gets a lot of contact, a lot of weak contact is kind of his goal. And he's not really trying to miss bats with his fastball. I know when I saw him, I think he got one swing strike with his fastball, but he had 16 with his slider. And that his breaking ball is, or slider is, you know, that's the swing and miss pitch. And I think that's the only real above average pitch in his arsenal. And that's the one that he's going to have to use to miss bats, because I'm not sure he's going to miss bats with the fastball and the changeup. And I think that's why you're seeing the strikeout numbers are so low. Is that he's kind of right now only got one pitch that he can miss bats with, because his changeup too is a very interesting pitch. It's like 89 to 91 miles an hour, which when you're throwing, you know, in the low 90s is not a lot of separation, but
it's like a slow fastball.
Well, exactly. But I've seen it, and he'll throw some good ones that do have some nice drop on them. So it's just he's an interesting guy, and he's someone who clearly really like thinks about pitching. He'll vary his, you know, starting spot or where he starts on the rubber depending on the handedness of the hitter. His breaking ball shape will vary. You know, some will look more curvish, some will be more, have more tilt and be more sliderish. And he just really seems to think about pitching.
Yeah.
And that's what I think will serve him well. You know, he's got that kind of that strong pitchability, strong feel on the mound. And if he can just, the control is good, he can just refine the command a little bit. I think it's more like he can get in as a bulk type. But yeah, just the lack of a bat missing fastball is what keeps him from being a potential starting prospect, or, you know, more of a late inning reliever. I think that bulk role is perfect for him long term. And then I think, did you ask about someone else in that? Or no, that was it.
Well, I was going to ask about Jeremy Wu Yellen, and I have 2 points to make here. Because one, you look at his game log, 3 of the last 7 starts or 6 starts, he has pitched 4 innings and not given up a hit.
Mm-hmm.
And in a couple of those, didn't give up a walk. And, I mean, that is pretty dominant, although he has a 3.32 ERA, which isn't outstanding. He's had a couple blowout outings, but if you look at his game log, he has really had way more good than bad. But I haven't been able to see Wu Yellen. I know he was a 4th-round pick last year. Wonder what your thoughts were on him. And then my second point, which is my biggest pet peeve about the minor leagues, is if these starters are going to go 3 or 4 innings, I think the scorekeeper should have the discretion on who gets the win, because he probably shouldn't be 0-3 this year. So if we're going to limit starters to go 3 or 4 innings, they should probably be able to get a win in a game that the team ends up winning.
That's funny. Wu Yellen's another interesting one, because I think that he's probably a reliever long term, but I think his stuff, he could be actually pretty good there, because he's got a good fastball. He's up into the high 90s from the left side. He's got a decent slider and then a changeup too. But it's just the command and control with him is the issue. You know, he's walking, I think it's like 14% of hitters or something he's facing this year. 13% of the hitters he's facing this year. He's not giving up a lot of hits, but, you know, and he's striking out a ton of guys, but it's just the walks are the issue. And I think he's not going to have enough fastball command in order to be a starting pitcher long term. But I think he could be actually a really good reliever. And that's kind of the consensus from scouts I've talked to who have seen him this year, is they think that the bullpen will be his ultimate destination, but that he could be pretty good in there.
Awesome. Shelley, I kind of hijacked the last few minutes. Any remaining prospects that you wanted to ask about while we have Ian on here down the stretch? I know we're getting up close to an hour, so thanks for giving us so much of your time today, Ian.
Oh, no problem. It's great to talk to you guys. It's always fun talking about the Red Sox and the farm system.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ian, for, you know, actually being able to talk to you. I listen to the, Sox Prospects podcast all the time, so this is, like, awesome for me. But there's one other guy that I just kind of wanted to get your kind of like thoughts about, Brandon Bernacchi. I mean, you know, the complex league just started. Like, he's only played just like a handful of games, you know, maybe 2 handfuls of games. But his average is down, but he's still walking a lot, not striking a lot. Is this just maybe a small sample size? Am I just getting scared because I'm seeing an average of 231? What do you think about Brandon Bernacchi?
Sorry about that. I couldn't find the mute button. He's someone, I think it's just a small sample size thing. You know, he's someone that, yeah, I think he went 0-5 today. And if you take that out and then you take out the first 2 games of the season where he went 0-5 combined, you know, he's hitting 300, 491, 475 on the year. And he's definitely an advanced bat. He's got really good feel at the plate. He knows the strike zone. You'll take a walk, as you astutely pointed out. And I think it's just, yeah, just the small sample sizeness of the early in the season, you know, coming before today, or I guess not before his last game, he was on like a 5-game hitting streak, multiple hits in 3 of the 4 games. I've talked to some people who have seen the FCL team down there, and he definitely can hit. You know, he's someone who has really good feel at the plate. I think just the thing you got to watch with him is he's very small. He's probably 5'8", 5'9", and not convinced he's a shortstop long term. So when you're on the shorter side and you're not necessarily a shortstop, you really are going to have to hit. And I think that's something that he's going to have to do long term. And that's kind of why I wouldn't be surprised if he's someone that he could potentially be looked as someone they could move in a trade to shore up things at the deadline. I wouldn't be surprised if he's someone that teams were interested in because of his hitting ability, but also someone the Red Sox are willing to trade because they have some middle infield depth at the low minors.
All right, awesome. Well, Ian, I'm going to give you a chance to promote your work, your website, and any pieces that you've had come out recently or we can look for over at Sox Prospects.
Yeah, thanks. If you like what you heard, come check out SoxProspects.com. We've got scouting reports on pretty much everyone in the system. They get updated when we get the information. I got firsthand reports on games. We got our podcast, as Shelly talked about. We had Jim Callis from MLB Pipeline on in the last episode, kind of talking about the Red Sox draft. So that was a lot of fun. And just check out the news page too. This week I wrote about the trade deadline, kind of what I would like to see the Red Sox do to upgrade the team, and then who are the types of players I think would be available. And then also going up, I think maybe tomorrow, we have some firsthand scouting reports from when I was able to see Josh Winkowski, Durbin Feldman, and a couple other guys recently. So check that out on the news page and check out the podcast and for all your Red Sox prospect needs. And of course, listen to this prospect podcast too, because it has been a great addition to the Red Sox prospect world this year.
Well, we appreciate that. And yeah, I can't recommend the website and the podcast highly enough over at Sox Prospects. Follow Ian at Ian Condal. You can follow Shelly at ShellyV_643. You can follow me at BobOsgood15. I had a blast. Thanks so much for joining us, Ian. And we will talk to you all next week.